Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts. Hey, it's Francis. And have you ever wondered, who was the first person to eat a sea urchin? Like, yes, this living rock with teeth and moving spikes. Please, give it to me for lunch. Anyway, I always enjoy any chance to imagine the rest of that person's life choices. But I hope you enjoy it too, because this week we're bringing back an episode featuring one of the most fascinating conversations I have ever had about sea urchins. Have a listen. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. It might sound odd for a food show to be saying this, but deliciousness can be a real problem.
You should think of them as a wonderful hybrid between an artichoke and an egg, or an avocado and an egg.
Now imagine tasting that, or something that could be described that way. That's Ali Buzari talking about uni, sea urchins, which, if you've never tried them, are incredible and weird in a great way. But when something tastes new to you and is delicious, you want it, and your friends want it, and more people want it, and seemingly only it, until we get to the point where the good earth has no more of whatever it is to give. And in a lot of places, sea urchins are super overfished. But I'm not here to bum you out today, because Ali's got a different take on the story. Now, before we get to him, Ali is one of the most interesting dudes in the world. He is a biochemist and an author and a trained chef, and who happens to spearfish and freedive in his spare time. So hey, Ali, it's great to talk with you today.
Thanks, Francis. It's good to talk to you.
I want to talk to you about sea urchins.
Let's do it.
You know, they are like the most terrifying looking animals on Earth. Like, they look like headless ghosts of porcupines, but are alive and live in the sea. And they like kind of move around, their spines move. And then you eat them and it's like, oh my God, that is the most amazing flavor. Like Ruth Reichel, actually, I read recently, she calls them her single favorite flavor in the world. And I first actually want to ask you, because you're a scientist, what makes a sea urchin delicious? Like, they taste like butter that you harvested from the sea. And I want to know, scientifically, how is that possible?
Yeah, totally. I mean, sea urchins are certified heavy metal. They're covered in this, like, armor of calcium carbonate. And they've got these spines that help them move around. And they breathe out of their feet. And they're just weird. They are so delicious, though. As heavy metal as they look, they are actually so delicious because of how vulnerable and open to the elements they are. So Think about any time you've gone in the ocean for an extended period of time. Your skin starts to get all pruny. You kind of feel dehydrated. I personally always crave shrimp. A lot of changes happen to you because you're basically sitting in the world's biggest bathtub full of brine. So now imagine living your entire life immersed in that super salty, briny environment without the luxury of skin to keep all of your insides functioning and where they should be. So sea urchins don't have skin. All of that salt,
like,
that
unlike
they're sitting
fish
in,
and
unlike fish or even an octopus. So all that salt that they're sitting in has free rein to pull all of the moisture out and just turn them into marine raisins. So to combat that effect, sea urchins get into an arms race with the salt in the water. They stockpile stuff that water likes to attach to. They stockpile sugars, amino acids, and salts, which is incredible for us because those are maybe the three most delicious types of molecules in the edible world. They're sweet, salty, and umami. And they brine themselves for us. And so when you hear people talking about – and this is true for oysters too. When you hear people getting thoughtful and poetic about their favorite oysters from wherever it is in the world, they'll often talk about the briny, brackish water that those oysters come from. And that isn't just prose, it is the reason that those animals are delicious.
Oh, that's incredible. So, like, you thought, okay, so you dive for urchins, and actually the reason why you're in today is because you just wrote this really fascinating story about diving for purple urchins off the coast of California. And in that story for Savoir magazine, you're talking about how it's good to eat them. So I live in the East Coast, and there are Maine urchins, and I hear those are over-harvested, and that's a problem, and sea urchins, uni, sometimes called uni, have become more and more popular with chefs. And so, like, you know, they're getting into all these, like, chefy dishes, and they become this old cliche where chefs are putting uni on everything and we're over-harvesting all of them. But part of your story is about how they are overrunning the ecosystem of, like, the coast of Northern California. So what's going on there?
Yeah. So the West Coast is a very different urchin story than the East Coast. Here, there are thousands of times more urchins than there have been or should be historically. And it's a combo of factors. Obviously, several of them are our fault as humans. some of them are just freak accidents, but it's a combo of climate change, warming the waters, and causing problems with how the kelp get nutrients. There was a freak outbreak that killed a bunch of sea urchins' natural predators, which are sea stars. Starfish, uh-huh. But I have to say sea stars, or biologist friends will yell at me. we're also still reaping what we sowed at the end of the 1800s by almost eradicating sea otters in this part of the coast, because they also naturally prey on sea urchins. And so what's happening is this explosion of urchins has taken them from filling this very docile niche of just hanging out and vacuuming up the bits and scraps that need to be taken care of on the ocean floor to becoming these zombie hordes that are literally mowing down 95%+ of the kelp in Sonoma and Mendocino County, which is a huge – yeah, it's an incredible bummer. And there has been an immediate ramification already where the local recreational abalone fishery – which is where most non-commercially fished abalone come from, is closed, maybe forever, because the abalone also feed on kelp and they just can't compete with the sea urchins. And after that, everything that depends on the kelp as the anchor to the food chain will be swiftly kicked out.
Yeah, and the kelp are like basically like the forest of the seas, right? So it's about you're basically deforesting the entire underwater ecosystem there.
Yeah, and it's deforestation that happens crazy quick. Like I moved to Sonoma County a few years ago, right before my friend and colleague Kyle was opening his restaurant, Single Thread, and his CDC, Aaron, who I co-wrote the piece with, taught me how to spearfish, which was just the coolest hobby for a chef to have that you could possibly imagine. And when we started literally 4 years ago, it was like diving down through this canopy. It was like a submerged tropical jungle, and there was fish flitting in and out of the shadows of the kelp, and it was this amazing thing. And now this spring, when we've started to go for the season, it is almost like diving down to the surface of the moon, and you can see it in the photos.
Oh, my God.
It's a bunch of craggy, rocky outcroppings that are just dotted with bright flashes of, like, 80s Prince purple.
That's crazy. But, okay, so normally when you have like invasive species, you know, it's like, oh, well, we should just eat them. But it's hard because you have to convince people to eat things like lionfish that they've never had before or Asian carp or whatever. But like sea urchins are incredibly delicious. They're expensive. Chefs want to use them. Why isn't there a huge commercial fishery for these purple urchins? Like why aren't we just like grabbing them all and eating them?
Right. Well, first of all, so they're not invasive actually. They're from here.
Okay.
They're just out of control.
Okay, sure.
But one of the issues with purple urchins versus the green urchins that you guys maybe get on the East Coast or the bigger red urchins that people also harvest out here is that they are a smaller cousin. They're a smaller species. So their roe, which are the reproductive organs that people call uni, it's also smaller. But that doesn't mean that they're not commercially viable, and it definitely doesn't mean that they're not delicious. So in the 90s, there were actually a couple years where there was a huge documented push to enhance this purple sea urchin fishery on the West Coast. And I think we exported 300,000 or so pounds of purple sea urchin to Japan, where they were actually highly prized because they were smaller and more delicate, and you could incorporate them in dishes, I think, in a way that was more subtle rather than just plopping this big, giant, fatty tongue on a piece of rice.
Mm-hmm. Like your uni sushi or whatever.
That is still, at this point, what the mainstream foodie consumer thinks of when they think of uni is they think of sushi. They think of Japanese food. They think of what they typically see on social media as these big, fat, robust uni tongues. And the reality is their applications in the kitchen go way beyond that.
Yeah. So we talked to you as a scientist before and then as a diver, and so now we talk to you as a chef. What can you do with them aside from just plopping them on some nice sushi rice?
Chemically and culinarily, you should think of them as a wonderful hybrid between an artichoke and an egg, or an avocado and an egg maybe is a better comparison. You ask somebody 10 years ago, what do you do with avocados? 9 out of 10 times they're going to say guacamole, and now they're in everything, almost to a point of self-parody. Same thing with uni. They are full of fat and protein, so you can use them as a source of browning. So you can incorporate them into a barbecue marinade or a yakitori marinade. You can use their fattiness to enrich doughs. They make some of the best brioche that I've ever tasted. I sweated down urchins with andouille sausage and used their fat to make probably the best dirty rice I've ever made.
Does sound like millionaire food, right?
but it doesn't need to be. If you live on the West Coast for like a $44 a year fishing license, you can even pick these things off the shore. You can gather 35 per person per day right now. And
we should be, is what you're saying, because we need that kelp to come back.
But I mean, we have this pretty horrendous track record of just decimating anything we get excited about. This is the universe offering up a small chance at redemption, where we can put our fervor to good use.
Ali, this is awesome. You are awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Come out to Sonoma County and I'll feed you some urchin.
Ali Buzari is the author of Ingredient, Unveiling the Essential Elements of Food. And you can read his article on purple urchins in Saveur. Coming up next...
I'm trying to pass around the word quanto basta, which is basically this principle from Pellegrino Artusi and L'Arte del Mangiar Bene, which is a book that has been in print for over 170 years in Italy. And he uses in many of his recipes Q period B period, quanto basta, as much as is enough, as much as is needed, or as much as you like.
That's the author Rolando Beramendi, and I could listen to him talk about anything. Which is good, because he's going to tell us about something I used to think I would never want to eat. Rice salad. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. In every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking an amazing meal. Listen as Ina does what she does best, make good conversation and delicious food, while making it sound fun and easy. This season, Ina dives into conversation with astronaut and colonel Nicole Mann. As Ina teaches Nicole how to make seared scallops with celery root puree, they talk about everything from family to what foods Nicole really craves when she's in space. And listen in as Ina and Pulitzer Prize-winning writer David Remnick talk about music lessons and the value of developing language skills before joining their spouses for a lively conversation over a comforting dish of chicken parmesan. If you love a good chat over a great meal, you'll love Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts. This is The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters, and I'm your host, Francis Lam. I have to admit it, as a Chinese person, the idea of eating cold rice kind of upsets me. And so I'll be honest, I resisted our next interview for a long time because it's about rice salad. Rice salad. Like, even the words freak me out a little. Rice salad.
But then that gnarly July 4th heat wave hit, and I was like, I will eat anything cold. I, in fact, will only eat cold food. Please freeze the rice before you give it to me. And so I finally came to Rolando Berrimendi's rice salad ideas with an open mind, and they're really good. Rolando is an Italian food importer, a great cook, and the author of Autentico, Cooking Italian the Authentic Way, and our contributor, Russ Parsons, talked with him about the Italian tradition of rice salad.
They tend to be somewhat of a main and only course during the, you know, a hot summer lunch. However, you also see it many times during the summer months being served as a primo, so as a first course instead of pasta, because you kind of like make it during the day and then let it sit and get all the flavors, you know, sort of amalgamated into it. And then you don't have to, you know, boil pasta during a hot summer night. So they tend to be very much take the place of primo, a first course in an Italian meal.
What kind of rice do you use and how do you cook it?
Well, I do it exactly the same way that as you would do spaghetti. I have one of those, I think the most important pot that I have and the most important instrument that I have in my kitchen besides my knife is it's a pasta pot with an insert. The ones that you can, you know, just throw the pasta and then it has the colander built in and you can actually like lift it up and then drain it into the sauce. Well, I do the same thing with carnaroli rice, which is the longest and, how do you say, valued or more precious grain that we grow in Italy, because it's the longest and it has the largest amount of starch inside. So it's very toothsome and very, you know, it remains al dente for a long time. So basically, I just, you know, put a lot of water with salt, and then I just toss, you know, a cup or two if I want to have more for the rest of the week, then cook it like pasta and just check every now and then and taste when it's al dente. And then what I do is you lift the colander right away and you bring it to the sink and you shock it with running cold water. And then I spread it in a big cookie sheet or in a baking dish. And what I do is then you just drizzle a little bit of, you know, olive oil and with your fingers, you just spread it out and cool it off. And so then think of it as if you were using that rice as a spaghetti. You can come up with different sauces and variations, different ideas, but you use that rice as if you were dressing it as pasta.
Carnaroli can be a little bit difficult to find sometimes. Could you use arborio, or would it be better to go with long grain?
I think carnaroli is actually, you'll be surprised how widely available it has become right now, and there are many different brands available. You can also find it online very well. Arborio is also long grain rice from the same area as carnaroli. But I find that it doesn't stay al dente as long as carnaroli. Carnaroli has a much more stronger bite. And So for rice salad, it would be worth seeking it, you know, because it's a really incredible grain.
So, okay, we've got the rice cooked and we've done the initial cooling on it. Now we have this blank canvas. What kind of ingredients do you add to a rice salad? What are the things that you're thinking about?
Well, the recipe that I chose to include in Autentico was the Contessa's rice salad, because she was the woman who I work with in Piemonte, in Torino. She actually told me that in the 60s, she was the first one to start making these little rice salad with everything sort of like chopped in the same. Can you imagine the labor to make vegetables or different types of ingredients, chop them up to the size of the rice, so it becomes this colorful specks of, you know, different vegetables in the rice salad, and served it with some hard-boiled eggs and, you know, even broken tuna in there. It's just the most important thing, I think, for me, is that you try to chop everything as finely as possible. Then every bite that you will take of the salad, it will be a little bit different, so that not everything becomes homogeneous.
Are there other variations that you like?
My way of cooking and my way of thinking is always to make things in a perfect proportion. So it should be a third rice, a third another ingredient, and a third another ingredient. For example, my favorite rice salad is to make it with shrimp and zucchini, and dressed with really good extra virgin olive oil and a splash of maybe some, if you like some acid, splash of lemon, and use some lemon zest as well. I'm a firm believer that less is more in many cases. And, you know, in this particular case with a summer salad, I think it's, you know, the simpler the better is the rice that it's the star of the dish.
Now, you mentioned dressing it with olive oil and maybe a little bit of lemon juice. But I know, like with the Contessa's rice salad, she uses a mayonnaise base for it.
I know.
How do you decide what dressing combinations that you might use?
Well, I think that that's, as I always say, options and substitutions. You know, I'm trying to pass around the word quanto basta, which is basically this principle from Pellegrino Artusi and L'Arte del Mangiar Bene, which is a book that has been in print for over 170 years in Italy. And he uses in many of his recipes, and I've used it throughout Authentico, is Q period B period. Quanto basta, as much as is enough, or as much as is needed, or as much as you like. I think that we need to encourage people to not be afraid to create your own interpretations. If you like one thing more than another, then do it. And if you want to put more olive oil, I drench my everything with good extra virgin olive oil because I love it so much. And if you want to use one type of vinegar, if you want to use another type of vinegar, if that's the only one you have in your pantry, then go for it. But just, I think that the most important thing is to taste as you add things. I mean, just put the rice in a bowl and then start adding things. I mean, it's not half a cup of this and half a cup of that. Just throw it in. And I mix always the rice salad with my hands. And then just start adding, you know, a little bit of things at a time. And as much as you have, you know, maybe leftovers in your fridge, just be creative as long as you just keep tasting and add as much as is enough.
That's a very generous description, but this is an Italian dish. So I'm sure that there are things that must never, absolutely never, under any circumstances, be done with a rice salad. One just wouldn't do that. Anything come to mind?
Yeah, maybe put ketchup or balsamic vinegar on it. It's so, you know, I think that's the beauty about our country. Italy is so amazing that if you think about it, it's the Contessa might make it, you know, one way, but then the next door neighbor makes it another way. What I love about Italy is that there's no right or wrongs. You just do it. I think that for the most part, we wouldn't put disparate ingredients, such as, you know, ingredients that are very wintered, like, let's say, something with truffles in the summertime or porcini mushrooms. We would save those for the winter and use them in risotto instead. So I think the seasonality is a very important aspect to a rice salad. I think the fresher and the simpler, the better.
Rolando, it all sounds so delicious. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, my honor is all mine. Thank you so much for having me.
Rolando Beramendi is the author of Authentico, Cooking Italian the Authentic Way. Russ Parsons is the author of How to Pick a Peach. And for your rice salad needs, Rolando gave us his recipe for the Contessa's rice salad. And it's at splendidtable.org. Now, if you don't know Alison Roman, you're probably going to want to. And if you do know her, you probably know her as the queen of the chocolate chip cookie. I mean, seriously, Google the recipe, bake it, live your best life. It's like she rebelled against the chocolate chip cookie and somehow made it better. But it wasn't the sweets in Alison's cookbook, Dining In, that blew our contributor Shauna Seaver away. It was her ideas for the thoroughly modern breakfast.
One of the chapters that really grabbed my eye is the one on savory breakfasts. It's really a unique collection of recipes. It's not breakfast. It's not brunch. Can you describe it for us?
Well, you know, I didn't want to just call it breakfast because, while, you know, when I think of breakfast, I think of two eggs, a side of bacon, some toast, maybe some hash browns. So I wanted to kind of draw attention to that world of you know, savory porridges and those skillet hashes that's not a shakshuka and you know, kind of introduce people to different ways to start their day. There's a salad in there. And, you know, I think that people, the way that people eat now, especially first thing in the morning, is changing a lot. And I think that when I eat at home, you know, savory granola is a big part of it. Eggs, of course, but, you know, what I do with those eggs. And I make savory porridge with Parmesan and soy and scallion. And I want that really hearty, homey savoriness first thing. And I've just never been a sweet breakfast person at all. So I wanted this to be very personal.
Well, there's so much about this chapter I want to ask you about. One of those things is the flavor combinations that you mentioned, the savory barley porridge with parmesan and soy, which I think is such a great combination. You have cheddar and kimchi. What are some of those other flavor combinations that are really unique that we need to start incorporating into our savory breakfast routine?
Well, I think with those, you know, one thing that I think people think when they hear, oh, you're putting soy sauce in something and it must feel, you know, Asian inspired, or Parmesan, does it feel Mediterranean or Italian? But I think that really what I'm getting at is you don't need a ton of ingredients. You just need really intensely flavored ones. So the cheddar and the kimchi, that recipe is really cheddar, kimchi, and eggs pretty much. And within those three ingredients, you get something really, really special and really amazing that you wouldn't otherwise, just because those two ingredients on their own are already so powerful. And same thing with something like Parmesan and soy. You're just using them as a seasoning agent, right? Just to kind of introduce a little bit more flavor rather than just salt into your breakfast. And, you know, I don't know. I think that eating something like a bowl of chickpeas with chorizo for breakfast is a little intense sometimes, but sometimes it's exactly what you need. And, you know, while it's not a revolutionary flavor combination necessarily, I think that to think of something like that for breakfast is definitely interesting.
Well, and it's so satiating and nourishing. And I was really impressed by the fact that you do some very produce-heavy meals in this section, which we don't usually think about first thing in the morning. And you mentioned the salad earlier, and mm-hmm. you have this great call out about the morning after breakfast salad, which is really more of a concept than a recipe. How do we do it?
Yes. Well, it can be anything you want it to be, which is the beauty of the morning after breakfast salad. And this recipe was something that I first made, actually, while I was visiting one of my best friends in Maine, where she lives. And we had, of course, bought too many crabs and lobsters the day before because we were so excited to eat them all. We steamed them all and we're just, you know, looking at the bounty and thinking, okay, well, there's literally no way we are going to finish all of these. And so the next morning, I put all the leftover lobster into a salad with these really beautiful lettuces that we had gotten from this little farm down the road. It was very idyllic. I don't live my life that way all the time, and I don't expect anyone else to. But in this moment, it was really special. And, you know, of course, with all those lobsters and crabs we had the night before, there was a lot of wine. And so we were feeling a little maybe hungover, or definitely uh-huh. hungover. And but, you know, the idea of using up our leftovers, A, but also B, eating a bowl of really lemony, herby, leafy greens just made us feel amazing afterwards, you know. And I think that we think of a hangover breakfast or a savory breakfast in that capacity as something really fatty with, you know, cheese and sausage and eggs and lots of hot sauce. But, you know, for me, what I want is oftentimes a bowl of really, really nice greens with lemon and olive oil and salt. It kind of resets the system. But
it's like a
tonic. Know, also,
yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And then that sort of evolved because I realized that, you know, anytime I go out, if I have leftovers, which I try to bring home, or if I'm cooking at home and I have leftovers, especially from a larger cut of meat or pork chops or whatever, using up any roasted vegetable along with that leftover meat in a salad is also awesome. And you don't have to heat anything up. You can kind of just fridge clean out a little bit. You know, you have a half of a fennel bulb, throw it in there. You have two rogue radishes rolling around in your crisper. Like, definitely slice those up and put them in there too. It's kind of a free form, build your own, choose your own adventure salad, really.
Well, before everyone starts thinking that this chapter is too virtuous to be fun, you also have eggs cooked in chicken fat.
Yes.
Which is pretty meta as far as breakfast goes.
Yeah, it was an accident, really. I mean, I literally had leftover chicken fat and just kept thinking of ways, how can I use this up? Because I didn't want it to go bad. And it was so delicious. It was really highly seasoned chicken fat. And I was like, is it wrong to fry an egg in this? And I did, you know, some deep diving. I thought a lot about it. I really dug deep. I did some soul searching. I never answered that question, but it is delicious. It is really, truly excellent.
No, it sounds genius. Well, it was great talking with you, Allison. Thanks so much.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Allison Roman's book is Dining In, Highly Cookable Recipes. Shauna Seaver is the author of Real Sweet, and you can find Allison's recipe for baked eggs with crushed chickpeas, chorizo, and breadcrumbs on splendidtable.org. And you do not have to wait for the morning for it. All right, let's talk. Get to us any way you like. 1-800-537-5252. Or you can find us at Facebook or Twitter. And we have Larry calling from St. Paul. Hi, Larry. How are you?
Hi, Francis. I'm just fine. Thank you.
Yeah. What would you like to talk about?
Well, I've got this recipe for spicy popcorn that I developed about 5 years after my return from India in 1974. I spent a year in India studying Montessori education. And when I got there in 1973, I realized they didn't have any popcorn. And I loved popcorn. We were living in a smallish place on Shreya's campus in Gujarat. And I was going to school. And a lot of times we were making our own food. So I developed a recipe for spicy ground nuts, which is what they call peanuts in India. And I made them in a chapati pan over a kerosene stove. But I developed a really great recipe. And then when I came back home in 74, I continued to eat the spicy ground nuts to make them. And then I eventually evolved over the next 2 or 3 years a recipe for spicy popcorn. So
your love for popcorn would be unabated.
Yeah, yeah. But here's the interesting thing. So I developed this recipe, and I started sharing my popcorn. And what I found, to my delight, was that people couldn't stop eating it. Children loved it. It was spicy. Cool. It had lots of flavor. It wasn't hot. I didn't add cayenne.
Spicy in the sense that you were using spices, not chilies.
Yeah. Right. And so I wanted to talk with you about it, partly because I'm wondering if it's the combination of things. You probably can figure out what most of the ingredients are. So I have like organic yellow popcorn, coconut oil. I add turmeric to the oil in the popcorn before it pops.
Ground turmeric?
Ground turmeric. For subtle flavor and for color. And then after it pops, I add salt, granulated garlic, cumin, cinnamon, pepper, spike, and nutritional yeast. Those are the basic things I always add.
Wow.
So I don't know how I discovered to add nutritional yeast. I just, you know, I'm a person that just throws stuff together and eats it. But I discovered that movie theaters, small independent movie theaters in St. Paul, Minneapolis, started putting nutritional yeast out in addition to cheese powder to add to their popcorn. And so I'm wondering, is this a magical kind of a, is there something about the nutritional yeast that added to it just makes it impossible to stop eating? Sort of like Doritos, you know?
You know, I do think so. Wait, did you say they're like Doritos?
Like Doritos. Doritos are really hard to stop eating.
Okay, so I know someone, okay, this is so crazy. I know someone who refers to popcorn with nutritional yeast as hippie Doritos. It really is. And I think, okay, so first of all, the combination of flavors sounds great. You have turmeric, you have garlic, you have these like savory flavors. The coconut oil obviously is rich. But then the cinnamon, you know, adds this cool sort of sweet kind of spicy note without, like you said, it being spicy in the tongue. So I think there's already so much going on that sounds delicious. And the nutritional yeast, like I said, it's kind of like it's thought of as being like a health food store kind of like rerun, or sometimes, you know, people think of it as like hippie food. I think today it's getting sort of a little bit more of a revival because it's sort of cheese-like in flavor. And so it's vegan. So I think, you know, it's like quote unquote vegan cheese powder. But I think what's really key about it is, it has, I think in some ways it's sort of cheesy, but really it's about the fact that it has this, it has some umami, and it's an interesting product. It's made by, I forget exactly what like the base is, but the yeast, it's like a wild yeast that grows. And so it's a product of natural fermentation. And so you know, lots of pickles or sauerkrauts or certainly cheeses and cured meats, you know, they have that depth of flavor. And so this is the just kind of skimmed yeast that has been, you know, that's been growing off this base, powder it. And so you're getting this concentrated, beautiful, sweet umami flavor. It just sounds like an awesome addition to all those different spices. That sounds super great.
Yeah, it's really great.
Well, thanks so much for the call, Larry. And thank you for the idea for popcorn. I'm going to make that.
You bet. Thanks a lot.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Coming up, more conversation with you, and
I cannot honestly say that I know every technique for every falafel I've ever had, but I will say that the way that we've made it with the tangzhong, I've never had one as good as that.
That's El Simone from America's Test Kitchen with a wild technique for falafel that comes from Chinese bread baking. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters. And we're back. Call us 1-800-537-5252 or find us on Facebook or Twitter. And we have Marissa from Hotlanta. Hey, Marissa, how are you?
Hey, I'm good. And we don't really call it Hotlanta, but I'll forgive
you. I'm sorry. I just wanted to get so much into the Outcast vibe.
Oh, it's okay. So I am kind of a recent vegetarian, and for the most part, it's been pretty easy. I love vegetables. I love fruit, any kind of veggie. Sure. But the only thing I really miss are those long, drawn-out Sunday dinners, like roast chicken or beef bourguignon. Right now, I put on a pot of beans or make your weapons-grade ratatouille, which is delicious. any other suggestions for any other dinners I can have cooking away? Particularly, you know, on Sundays. I like to listen to your show on Sunday and just have something cooking away. So any other suggestions?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think, I think the whole Sunday roast vibe is such a cool vibe, right? It is. I love the idea if you have something big in the oven, just kind of hanging out, and forces you to be there. So you want to bring other people around with you. And if you're cooking vegetarian, sometimes it, you know, what's the obvious replacement for like a whole ham? It's like, well, a whole pumpkin. Like, yeah, it's not necessarily a super like one-to-one switch out kind of thing. But I would think a couple things right away. I have a friend, Anna Heasel, who I don't know if this was like because she was sensing a vibe or she just like declared it. But she's declared that 2018 is the year of lasagna. She said that one day, and all of a sudden, everywhere I look, like every food magazine is running stories about lasagna. I'm like, oh my God, she's onto something. It's a lasagna moment. But lasagna actually is kind of a perfect, obviously very vegetarian-friendly analogy to that. You would take a nice long time assembling it. You know, you can find your mix of cheeses, get your ricotta just right, you know, season it down, cook your sauce. And I could also see you slipping in some nice roasted eggplant in there. Maybe you would do like a sort of like a lasagna eggplant parmesan hybrid where you slice eggplant like the big long way and bread it and fry a few pieces of that and layer some of that in there. I could see some nice roasted vegetables in there, or maybe even some like roasted vegetables and maybe like slice some fennel kind of thin and drop the fennel in there so they keep a little crunch, so you have like a variation in textures. You have some nice cooked vegetables, a little bit of, you know, less cooked, so they still have that crunch to it, a little bit crispness. I would definitely play around with some like cool lasagna vibes. Like that could be a very Sunday, take all day kind of thing. The other thing I would think is you can also, rather than one big thing, kind of flip it and keep yourself busy by making lots of little things. So I think maybe like a whole spread of mezze, right? So
I love that.
Yeah, so like you mentioned beans, but you can make like a really beautiful homemade scratch hummus from dried chickpeas. And I don't know if you've ever made, like hummus is like such a, it's delicious, but it's like it's such a everyday grocery store thing at this point that like most people don't think of making it themselves. But when you make a good hummus, and like the Ottolenghi recipe in Jerusalem, for instance, is super famous and is amazing. Eating that fresh.
It can't be store-bought,
Oh man, it's like still warm, and the chickpeas are like sweet and buttery, and the tahini and the olive oil, it's so good. So I would start with that, and maybe you can do a little bit of seasoned thick yogurt, maybe chop up a little bit of cucumbers and some mint leaves and a little grating of raw garlic in the yogurt, so that's a nice thing. And
my friend Doc, who's traveled a lot in Turkey, is a huge fan of this Turkish way of cooking vegetables. Well, basically, I'm like, oh my God, so good. What do you do? He's like, well, basically, you start with like an insane amount of olive oil and boil your vegetables in olive oil.
So he'll put
like an inch or, you know, of olive oil in a nice saucepan and then put in green beans or, you know, some kind of vegetable. Just go with green beans and simmer it, like basically slowly braise the green beans in the olive oil for like an hour, 45 minutes or an hour.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And you can, if it's getting into the tomato season, you can like cut a fresh tomato in half and grate it on the grater. So you get that like nice tomato pulp, get that in there, get maybe a couple of garlic cloves, maybe some onions, and just let it all braise together until the green beans are that like mushy consistency, but like have that. I think the thing with green beans is when you cook them a long time, they taste more like beans than like green, and I love that.
Mm-hmm.
Like they're not pretty to look at, but they have that like beautiful, sweet, complex, earthy flavor that comes out. So you have all that, but in this mixture of olive oil and the tomato and the garlic, it's just so good. And you know, get a whole bunch of those things, and if you're really feeling super ambitious, maybe like bake your own pita and have a huge spread. You know, like that's a great way to spend a Sunday, if you ask me.
That's a great idea, as all that stuff can be eaten throughout the week, too.
Yeah, exactly. Totally.
Love meze and love Turkish food, especially.
Awesome. Cool. Well, I hope that helped. I hope you have a couple weekends ahead of you now.
Yeah, I do. And I'll listen to your show while cooking it. So I can't wait.
Oh, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
All right. Take care, Marissa.
Bye.
Hey, we have Brianna calling.
Hey.
What would you like to talk about today?
Well, my husband is enjoying some of the flavors of spirits, and he has come to enjoy a whiskey sour, and so I want to make them for him, but I don't actually know how to, and I have this little bartender's recipe book, and it just says to add bitters, and I Googled bitters, and the Google was not helpful for me.
He's
left me with more questions about what bitters actually mean, because there was like so many different kinds, and then it just, you know, everything just says, you know, bitters to your taste, but I don't know what a bitter is, and I'm just lost.
Sure. Well, I'm glad you called, because I actually don't drink myself, but I actually happen to really like bitters. So it's like a very weird, tiny like window of opportunity where I could be helpful to you.
Yay.
So bitters are alcohol. They are alcoholic. If you have to avoid alcohol because you can't actually have like the substance, you can't have them. But in this case, they are typically an infusion of herbs or roots. A lot of bitters go way back in history to having like, you know, like various mountain herbs, and were probably seen as medicinal and things like that. But like, they are exactly what they sound like. They're bitter. They are little tinctures that will add a bitter note to whatever they go in. But the nice thing about them is, especially when you're talking about alcohol and cocktails, and there's so much that's usually acidic or sweet or herbal and aromatic, you have all these flavors, a little bit of bitterness really does help ground it and really helps the cocktail taste more balanced and just like full and satisfying. It's almost like you know, when you're cooking food and you're missing a little something, and oh, it's that little pinch of salt that really sort of like wakens it up, and it really like rounds it all out. Bitters often can do that for a drink, I think. Even though the flavor of bitter, the taste of bitter, a lot of people don't like on its own, when you mix it in with these other things, it can just give it a little more oomph. And, you know, like you've seen, there are tons and tons and tons of kinds. For a person new to bitters, to be completely frank, most of them will probably taste pretty similar. And so we'll be pretty interchangeable. So I would not freak out about like, oh my God, I need to find the exact right kind. A classic is called Angostura, Angostura.
Okay.
It's not expensive. It's a few dollars a bottle. They're everywhere. It's a classic bitters that you would shake into a cocktail. And what I would start with is, you can definitely start just putting it into the cocktails and a drop, two drops, three drops, tasting along the way until you find that it gets you somewhere good.
Okay.
I don't drink. I love bitters and soda, just like club soda,
cool.
And just shaking bitters. And sometimes it is for me, like I feel like literally two, three drops. You just get a tiny, tiny bit of the aroma. Because a lot of these bitters,
will have lots of floral notes and stuff like that too. So sometimes I just want to have a little bit of that really nice, beautiful scent while I'm just drinking soda water. And sometimes I like and like color the whole thing orange and feel like you taste that bitterness more and it feels like it's settling your stomach. You know, it does that kind of thing. It's pretty magical stuff.
That sounds really cool.
Yeah. So I would try, again, maybe start with an Angostura or something pretty classic. And then if you want to get geeky into it, there are all kinds of, you know, small batch bitters and orange bitters and cocoa bitters
and
bitters made with all kinds of different flavors that they infuse with all the other herbs and stuff like that.
Yeah, that's awesome. Thank you so much. Yeah, we're the geeky kind that kind of find something, we fall in love with it, and we go all out. So this sounds like a new adventure for us.
Oh, right on. Cool. This is definitely something you can geek out on.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Yeah, take care. Enjoy.
You too. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Remember, you can always get to us anytime. Facebook, Twitter, or just call 1-800-537-5252. A great falafel is the kind of food that just makes you happy to live in a world with human ingenuity. I mean, right, you look on paper and it's like, okay, it's a blob of fried chickpeas, but then you eat it. And there's a crunch in the shell, and the beans are sweet and earthy, and they hold on to the flavor of savory spices, and it's proof that humankind can take things from the earth and do good with them. And this week, El Simone from America's Test Kitchen adds to the long history of falafel innovation. Sally Swift got the word.
Hey, El, great to have you.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So I am ever so slightly obsessed with falafel, and I have made many a variety and eaten them in many places, and I have to say, there's a lot of bad falafel out there.
Yes, there can be quite some unsavory falafels in the world.
So what is the hard thing? What do we need to know about them?
Well, I mean, first, you should know that falafels are made with chickpeas. They can also be made with fava beans, but we make ours with chickpeas.
So let me ask, are these chickpeas cooked or are they just soaked?
These chickpeas are not cooked. They're soaked.
And is that traditional? Is that how they're usually done?
Well, here's the thing. I think the debate is actually, how is it really done? And I think lots of... You know, regions make them differently, although the Middle East, you know, claims the fame. I grew up in Michigan and we have like the largest Middle Eastern population. And so I've had lots of falafel and I've had them made in many different ways. Some were very good and some, you know, not so good. I think that we've managed to nail down a way to make them consistently delicious.
Now, we are talking about really making falafel here. This is not rehydrating a dried mix. We are starting from scratch, correct?
That's the only way to go, Sally.
All right. Tell me how to do it.
Okay. So first things first, we're going to start with uncooked chickpeas. And we let them soak overnight. And it should soak at least 8 hours. 8 to 24 is ideal, right?
Okay.
And we're doing this instead of using canned, because obviously canned are already in a solution. And more than likely, they've already been cooked for the sake of preservation, right? And so when you are trying to make your falafel batter with cooked chickpeas or over-soaked chickpeas, you'll end up with a pasty puree, which is a great way to get a hard, pasty falafel.
Yeah, they're just mushy. I mean, I've tried this, I have to say. So I didn't realize that these chickpeas are not supposed to be cooked.
No, they should not be cooked. It's best to start raw. We're going to cook them eventually. We don't need to double cook them.
Exactly. Right. Okay.
So so we have our chickpeas that have been soaked, and we go into a food processor with these chickpeas with some of my favorite herbs, onions, cilantro, and parsley, and some very warm spices, coriander, cumin, cayenne pepper, and a little salt. And we blitz those in the food processor. We're looking for a nice pebbly texture. We don't want the chickpeas to get too small. Maybe about the size of a sesame seed would be probably most specific.
So you want it chunky, not like looking like hummus.
Right.
Okay, so we have the coarsely ground chickpeas with their spices and their those beautiful green herbs and garlic. And then what is next?
Well, I think this is the part where people really get hung up or tricked up the most. They want to fry their falafels. They think they're at that point. But really, you need to add something to make the batter stick together. Because if you fried it at this point, they would definitely crumble in the oil. So we use an Asian bread baking step that's called tangzong, and it's pretty much whisking a little flour with some water and cooking that mixture briefly. In this case, we just cook it in the microwave for a few minutes until it becomes more like a pudding-like paste, right?
Huh.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And it's not a large amount, and it goes a long way, and you just add that pudding mix into your falafel batter of sorts, and you mix it together, make sure it's well incorporated, and now you have the kind of falafel batter that you want to fry.
Oh, that's so interesting, because I have definitely tried to just add flour before, and it has not been very successful. So I need to really do a cooked flour paste.
A cooked flour paste is the way to go. I mean, we've tried like just rolling it in flour. We've tried just adding flour to the mixture. You know, we've tried all these things, but this tangzong method is like flawless. It definitely gets the job done.
So, and do you guys deep fry your falafel balls, or are you a pan fryer?
We are deep fryers all day, every day. Deep frying is the way to go. Yeah, we deep fry. And so, you know, we just scoop about a tablespoon at a time. I do about 5 or 6 of them at a time because they're easier to manage. And then you only fry it for 5 minutes until they're golden brown.
And delicious. And then what do you like to top them with?
I love to top my falafels with tahini sauce. Which is a very simple sauce. Actually, it's one of the sauces I just like to keep in my house because I dip a lot of things in tahini sauce. But it's a simple tahini paste, Greek yogurt, lemon juice, some water, and salt and pepper it to taste.
Delicious. You can eat that on anything.
Anything.
Hey, Elle, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me, Sally. It was great talking to you.
Elle Simone is a food stylist and test cook at America's Test Kitchen. And you can find the recipe for falafel at splendidtable.org. And that's our show for this week. Thank you for spending a little bit of time with us. And until next week, eat well, drink well, and tip well. Remember, you can take us with you wherever you go. Subscribe to our podcasts at our website, on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you like to get your podcast. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.